What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Arun Shari, the first official White House videographer and the author of the new book, First Cameraman, and of course, Jewish. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. While Israel is embroiled in a conflict with the Hamas-Palestinian terrorists who control Gaza, it's hard in the Jewish world to talk about and think about other subjects. But the truth is that this war of missiles and rockets, rockets, by the way, are simply missiles without guidance systems, I've learned, will not conclude even with a final end to this latest Gaza war. And from Hamas's viewpoint, any ceasefire, indeed any treaty they make with Israel, will only be a temporary pause in their ultimate goal of destroying Israel and killing Jews. So far, international public opinion outside of the Arab world, which matters a lot in this conflict, has been pretty reasonable and mostly on Israel's side. Israel has done a far better job explaining itself to the world through the press and through instant media than it did 4 years ago during Operation Cast Lead, and that means there is much less anti-Israel noise out there, so far. Israel's surgical strikes into an intensely populated urban area like Gaza almost always hit their targets, which were Hamas terrorist leaders, rocket and mortar storage buildings, and Hamas terror headquarters. Sometimes, a very small percentage of the time, other people were killed and wounded. This doesn't lessen the pain of the death of civilians who were accidentally killed or maimed, however small that number might be compared to how much weaponry is being launched on both sides. Hamas habitually hides fighters in hospitals and schools, shoots rockets from right in front of populated areas and even from homes, and Israel has now found ways, most of the time, to only attack the fighters. But it's very tricky. Ultimately, the longer the conflict goes on and the more Palestinian civilians are killed, the sooner public opinion will swing against Israel. So what we can mostly hope and pray for is that the ceasefire holds and that peace returns to our homeland of the heart, Israel, and that it lasts longer than it did the last time this happened. Oseh shalom bimromav hu ya'aseh shalom. May the God who makes peace in the heavens above bring peace to Israel and to all this troubled world soon. In happier news, we are now officially in what we Americans call the holidays season, that period between Thanksgiving and New Year's when life focuses more on family and festivals and less on the things we spend so much of our time on regularly, like work and other ordinary duties. As Jews, we are perhaps more accustomed to living in holiday seasons than most, since we actually have lots more holidays than most other Americans do. In fact, the busiest holiday season for us comes in September and October, from Rosh Hashanah through Simchat Torah, a period of a month during which fully 14 days out of 30 are actually holidays in one way or another. So this November-December season is not such a crazy time for us. I mean, Hanukkah is just, as Adam Sandler puts it, 8 crazy nights. On the other hand, perhaps some Jewish wisdom on surviving and enjoying the holiday season would come in handy for all of you out there who have just about had it with catalogs, traffic, gift buying, deliveries, mailing services, and all the other trappings of the American retail end-of-the-year orgy of sales, spending, and advertising. Look, in truth, this has only just begun. The only thing that takes longer to complete than the American November-December holidays is the college football bowl season. So, if we here on Too Jewish can make this time of year a little easier for you out there, well, maybe we'll gain at least a few extra mitzvah points. To prepare you for this festive marathon, here are the top five rabbinic things to remember to help you through the holidays. Number five, the real purpose of holidays, Hanukkah, Christmas, New Year's, Kwanzaa, Advent, you name it, has nothing to do with purchasing anything for anyone. God doesn't care if you buy expensive presents for your spouse or child or secretary or mailman. God cares if you connect with them in good and meaningful ways. Number four, nothing you buy ever saves you money, even when it's 50% off or on a flash deal or a Groupon. Everything you buy costs you money. That's why you pay them, and they don't pay you. Number three, you should not spend more time and effort on what you buy for people than you do on talking to them. Number two, decorations look nice, within reason. You are not putting on a Broadway show in your home or on the outside of your home, and you will eventually have to clean it all up or put it all away. Exercise a little seichel, judgment. And number one, the best way to show your love for someone is not by writing a check. Unless it's made out to the Two Jewish Radio Show and mailed to me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, C-O-H-O-N. Why then, it's a very good way to show your love. Those are the top five rabbinic recommendations for surviving and enjoying the holidays season. And now, as part of our pre-Hanukkah musical preview, here's a favorite cut from Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, entitled Can I Interest You in Hanukkah? As the Jewish TV show host tries to convince his very Christian friend to switch to Hanukkah.
Can I interest you in Hanukkah? Maybe something in a festival of lights. It's a sensible alternative to Christmas, and it lasts for 7, for you, 8.
Hanukkah, huh? I've never really thought about it.
Well, you could do worse.
Is it merry?
It's kind of merry.
Is it cheery?
I've got some cheer.
Is it jolly?
Look, I wouldn't know from jolly. But it's not my least unfavorite time of year.
When's it start?
On the 25th.
Of December?
Kislev.
Which is when exactly?
I will check.
Are there presents?
Yes, indeed, 8 days of presents. Which means one nice one, then a week of dread.
Does Hanukkah commemorate events profound and holy? A king who came to save the world.
No oil that burned quite slowly.
Well, it sounds fantastic.
There's more. We have latkes.
What are they?
Potato pancakes. We have dreidels.
What are they?
Wooden tops. We have candles.
What are they?
They are candles. When we light them, oh, the fun, it never stops. What do you say, Stephen? You want to give Hanukkah a try?
I'm trying to see me as a Jew. I'm trying even harder. But I believe in Jesus Christ, so it's a real non-starter.
I can't interest you in Hanukkah. Just a little bit.
No thanks, I'll pass. I'll keep Jesus, you keep your potato pancakes.
But I hope that you enjoy them on behalf of all the goyim.
Be sure to tell the pontiff, my people say good yontif.
That's exactly what I'll do. Happy holidays.
That was part of our pre-Hanukkah musical preview from Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert in honor of the rapidly approaching Festival of Lights. It begins 2 weeks from last night, December 8th. Only 13 more shopping days until Hanukkah, folks. Well, minus 2 days of Shabbat. I guess that makes it 11. By the way, that Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert Hanukkah song is the only one I know of that actually tells you when the Hebrew date of Hanukkah is. And it comes from a rather assimilated source, imagine. Hanukkah is the season of miracles. On a more personal, miraculous level, how would you like to be an independent filmmaker and get a phone call asking you to dedicate the next few years of your life to documenting the life of the President of the United States? Find out what that feels like when we return on Too Jewish with our guest, Arun Chahari, the first cameraman. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Arun Chahari. He's a filmmaker who works in politics. He was the official first White House videographer, a position created for him at the beginning of the Obama administration. He's traveled extensively with the president, has a brand new book out called First Cameraman. Good morning. Welcome.
Thanks.
All right. So President Obama, before he was President Obama, initiated a variety of sort of new approaches to American politics. When did you become the first cameraman?
You know, I was brought into the campaign in June 2007, but I think unlike a lot of the other directives, innovations the campaign took, the video team was really something that developed organically over time. You know, when they set up the team, people like David Axelrod and David Plouffe didn't exactly know what the video team was going to do other than maybe just make sure the speeches were up. But as David Axelrod described to me when I was asking him about it after I left the White House, he said, we just thought that video would really be able to show the authentic life of the campaign online and knew that would be important.
You know, American politics has changed in a variety of ways over time, and a lot of times it just kind of depends on who's making the innovation, but it does seem sometimes people wander into it. I remember Bob Dole unveiling his website and everybody thinking it was a ridiculous attempt at seeming current, but President Obama had a very different vibe in the campaign and then, of course, as president. What's it like trying to capture a vibe?
That's a great question, and that was sort of exactly the mission on the campaign. I mean, it was to try to make sure the energy and the excitement that you saw when people actually got a chance to see Senator Obama translated into folks who didn't necessarily have the chance to go see him. And so I think, you know, honing in exactly on your question, I can give you a great example, which was, you know, I started traveling with the campaign fairly extensively. You know, at first I would just sit the speeches, but then as we got a plane and stuff, I started traveling inside the bubble. And it wasn't just me or the new media people. It was also the old advisors, you know, the old media advisors who were noticing that the best stuff we were getting was the behind-the-scenes stuff, that quote-unquote sort of had the vibe. And the actual video that made that really kind of turned the head of one of the consultants, whose name was John Del Cicato, was President Obama, or he was Senator Obama, looking into my camera and wishing a staffer a happy birthday. Just a simple, you know, quick video message. And he was like, well, this is what we should be doing all the time. It should be Senator Obama giving messages directly to the American people in a very casual, tone. And so it almost, and I've never put it that way before, trying to capture the vibe, but that is exactly what the task was. It was how to get that sort of spontaneous realness, that authenticity, and put it in front of as many people as possible.
We will talk much more with Arun Chaudhry, who is the author of First Cameraman. We'll hear about some of those famous White House satyrs and Obama's Senator Obama satyrs, too, when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows, streaming them from the website, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. As I always say, Thanksgiving is also a Jewish holiday. What else can you call it when you invite all of your relatives to come for dinner, including the ones you don't like, and then all of you overeat? Based by our American forefathers on the biblical festival of Sukkot, the Thanksgiving harvest holiday of ancient and modern Israel and Judaism, Thanksgiving fits perfectly into the Jewish view of the world. But there is even more to this story. It turns out that when President George Washington and the U.S. Congress first proclaimed November 26, 1789, as a national day of Thanksgiving, America's Jews followed their religious leaders in embracing, celebrating, and even sanctifying it. America's first native-born Jewish preacher that we know of, Chazan Gershom Seixas Mendez of Manhattan's Spanish and Portuguese congregation Sherit Israel, actually fashioned a special Shacharit service for America's first day of Thanksgiving, beginning with five special psalms and concluding with Adon Olam. That service included Seixas Mendez's passionately patriotic sermon, praising God for delivering our nation from British rule. That sermon made such an impression it was published throughout the new American nation within weeks of his delivery of it. That was the 18th century equivalent of going viral. Just shy of a century later, after President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed Thanksgiving an annual national holiday in 1863 in the midst of the Civil War, not too long after Gettysburg, the most prominent Reform rabbi of the American North, David Einhorn, delivered a powerful Thanksgiving Day sermon in Philadelphia's largest temple, Knesset Israel. analogizing the enslavement of America's blacks to the historic suffering of Jews since their enslavement in Egypt. Einhorn began his homily with American patriotism, describing the day as appointed by the President of the United States to be observed by the loyal portion of the land. But he concluded on a distinctively Jewish note, even during the Civil War. Bless Israel, imbue it with a spirit of devotion and thankfulness towards this land, the first that broke the chains its children wore for centuries. So, enjoy your leftover turkey and stuffing and pumpkin pie, and go see the new Lincoln movie, made by two Jews, by the way, Steven Spielberg and author Tony Kushner, and know that in your heart you have been observing a great Jewish festival. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Now, Hebrew is a fantastic language. It's the Lashon Kodesh, the holy language. It's a living tongue. It's the only language that I know of that was revived from spoken death after 1,800 years. Tell us a little bit about the Hebrew language.
You know, when you're asking me about the Hebrew language, in my mind, I think of a song written by Israeli songwriter and performer Ehud Banai, the Hebrew Man. And he basically sings, "Speak up the language of the Hebrew man." And that makes me think, what specific Hebrew did he refer to? Because we all assume that we know what do we mean when we're saying Hebrew. But the truth is that the Hebrew language have layers over layers over layers that comes out of 3,000 years of Jewish history, starting with the tribe of Judea, was the language of the Bible, language where they lived their lives, milked their cows, made their food in Hebrew. Then the Hebrew kind of transformed when we came to the time of the Mishnah. And you will find a Mishnaic style of Hebrew, which is different. Many different words, many different structures of verbs that were created at that time. Mainly you can refer that to Rabbi Judah the Prince, who edited the Mishnah. Of course, later on, when we're going into the Talmud, to the Gemara, we have huge elements in Aramaic that was influenced by Babylon, and Aramaic influenced the Hebrew also when we're going further on in history. And when we go up in time, getting to the Golden Age in Spain, and we're looking at Yehuda Halevi and his wonderful songs. By the way, Yehuda Halevi and his songs brought a very different sense of Judaism than what we know today. It was a combination of religion and what today we would call nationality or Zionism. Of course, at that time, there was no Zionism. There was no nationality. People didn't know the concept. But
it was religious Zionism. There was a desire to return to Zion still.
Right. Libi b'mizrach v'anochi b'sof b'arav. My heart is in the east and I'm at the end of the west.
Sure.
And the Hebrew also tweaked at that time. You see different phrases, different structures in the Hebrew. And that goes on and on for every century. Now that brings me to the modern Hebrew, to the, you know, to the slang that teenagers use today, or on the other side of modern Hebrew, to the language used by poet Yehuda Amichai, probably the most famous Israeli poet, and some would say the best Israeli poet of all of modern times. And it comes to awareness that you can't really understand the songs of Yehuda Amichai if you don't understand the Hebrew of Ben Yehuda that revived the language, the Hebrew of Yehuda Levi from the Golden Age, the Hebrew of Judah the Prince. You need to understand all the layers because he plays with those layers. And when we're talking about us as the Jewish people have the Hebrew language as our heart and soul, the Hebrew bookshelf. And if we won't find the way to teach ourselves this language to the level that we feel comfortable to play the game with all those layers, to understand all the slight changes and differences and tweaks, then we will lose a golden culture. We will lose this fortune. And we need to fight and find a way to teach our kids here in Tucson to know Hebrew and to know Hebrew well, to be able to speak it fluently, to read it and to write it, to create in our language, the Hebrew language.
From your mouth to God's ears, we say. In my business, I have to say my teacher, the late Ted Karmi, Alav HaShalom, was a fantastic poet and translator and gave me some of that sensibility. It's a beautiful piece. Thanks, Guy. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about your recent trip to Eastern Europe and Sarajevo, which is just a fascinating city. Tell us a little bit more about Sarajevo and, well, take us through the rest.
So just to wrap up Sarajevo, in the really old, incredibly big Sephardic synagogue in the old town, there still exists, contrary to reports in the Jewish Telegraphic Agency or whatever it's called, a Jewish museum.
It is still called JTA, telegraphs.
Okay.
Still.
Well, they said it closed, which is not correct. It's still open. It attracts a lot of visitors. When we were there, there were some French people and some Japanese people. And looking in the guest book, you can see that people from all over the world visit this incredible museum, which has a small part devoted to the Holocaust and a large part devoted to Jewish history in Bosnia.
Is that where the Sarajevo Haggadah is?
It's where it was. That is not on display because that's in the, I don't know, National Art Museum or something. And that museum is, in fact, closed for renovations or lack of funding or whatever.
Combination.
But the Jewish Museum is open and up and running.
Okay.
And it's in a very beautiful, very old building. And the only thing I wanted to add is that depending on who you ask, there's optimism that Sarajevo may one day return to its former status as a model of coexistence and tolerance and cosmopolitanism. There are other people who fear that because the schools are now separate for Serbs and Muslims and Croats, that the communities will grow more and more apart because young people will have less and less contact with each other. And the one thing that Tito created that used to help in this regard was the Yugoslav National Army forced people of different ethnic backgrounds to live together in the same barracks, to train together, to speak a common language. And that really helped break down some of the stereotypes. It led to a lot of mixed marriages, et cetera, et cetera. And that is less frequent now. So future of Sarajevo, uncertain. Future of Sarajevo's Jewish community, also uncertain since it's very much an aging community. Our next stop was Skopje, which is the capital of what the Greeks insist on calling the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, also known as Fyrom. Skopje also has an old Jewish community. It's also an Ottoman, was a provincial Ottoman capital. It was important in that sense. The old section of Skopje is purely a Turkish city. There's still a Turkish minority there, also an Albanian minority. So there's a fair percentage of Muslims, a tiny Jewish community left, a richer Jewish past. And then we took the short car ride, like 2.5 hours, down to Thessaloniki, which I've already talked about extensively on your show. Very important Jewish community. The one major city in Europe that for many centuries had a Jewish majority. There were more Jews than there were anybody else in that city. And so the common language of commerce was Ladino, which the locals refer to as Espanol. They don't distinguish between
Spanish
real Espanol
and
Ladino. But they still publish a magazine called El Avenir, The Future. And particularly the older people there still speak Ladino, sing in Ladino, rebuke their children in Ladino. It's quite amazing. It's a very warm and welcoming community, which I encourage any of your listeners to visit for any number of reasons. It's rich in Byzantine history, in Greek history, in Jewish history, and in Ottoman history. Great place, great food. When we were there, perfect weather, et cetera, et cetera. So it's been a pleasure sharing this most recent trip with you and your listeners, and I look forward to future sessions.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk about something else next week, but a great visit to that part of Europe with you. Take care. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A shadchan, a matchmaker, corners a poor student and says, "Do I have a girl for you?" "I'm not interested," says the student. "You will be when I tell you she's a very beautiful girl," says the matchmaker. "Really?" says the student, a little more interested. "Yes, and she's also very rich." "Are you serious?" The student's really interested now. "Of course I am. Would I lie to you? And she has a long line of excellent ancestry. She comes from a very noble Jewish family." "Wow, sounds pretty great to me," says the student. "But why would a girl like that want to marry me, a poor, starving student? She'd have to be crazy." And the matchmaker replies, "Well, you can't have everything." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. We are currently in the midst of a sequence of splendid Torah portions, rich in complexity, action, and misdeed, all blended together with some serious family dysfunction. This week's Sedra Vayishlach in Genesis continues the tale of Jacob, the most intriguing of the patriarchs, a man who rises above his own duplicitous nature to become the father of almost all of the tribes of Israel. As our story begins this week, Jacob is returning home to Canaan, having made good in the old country of Haran. He has 4 wives, 12 children, including 11 sons, and flocks of sheep and herds of cattle, great wealth in that day. As he is about to cross back into Canaan, he learns that his brother Esau, whom he wronged so seriously just before leaving home in a rush 20 years before, is coming to meet him with an army of some 400 men. Jacob is panicked by this news, deducing that Esau is not heading his way with 400 spearmen just to welcome him back home. To try to preserve at least half of his household, Jacob divides his family and possessions into 2 camps, carefully arranges a large gift for Esau, and that night goes onto a small island in the midst of a tributary of the Jordan River to contemplate his options. While he is there, a stranger comes to him. The Torah is unclear as to whether this nocturnal visitor is a man, an angel, a representative of God in some other way, even a character in a dream or an evil spirit. Jacob wrestles with this visitor the rest of the night. Finally, as dawn is breaking, he prevails. The stranger cannot break away, and before he can escape, Jacob insists the stranger give him a blessing. It is at this moment that Jacob is blessed with a new name, Yisrael, Israel, the first time that famous name is used. It means either Prince of God or, more likely, one who wrestles with God. And we, the children of Israel, that is Jacob, have been wrestling with God in one way or another ever since. As the angel tells Jacob, "Your name shall be called Israel, for you have contended with gods and men and have prevailed." Jacob, now known also as Israel, survives, and the reunion with Esau proves to be anticlimactic. Esau comes up to Jacob with all his armed men and gives him a big hug and a kiss. And if all is not quite forgiven, at least no blood is shed. The dramatic narrative of Jacob's struggle and triumph have become a metaphor for our own struggles with belief and family baggage. We are all descendants of Israel, Yisrael, the one who wrestled with God. And if we engage in that process for the sake of sacredness and belief, we too can triumph and reach our own promised land. Even during this season of merciless commercialism, holiness can be created and found. It is that very search and struggle that make us the people of Israel and give us a land engaged in that same pursuit. When we truly act as children of the one who wrestled with God, when we choose to wrestle ourselves with God, we elevate our lives and our experiences. May it be so in this season and all seasons. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Arun Shahari will tell us what it's like to be the closest witness to history every day as the first official White House videographer and a co-creator of the famous Obama Passover Seders, by the way, when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Rockets from Gaza continued to strike southern Israel, although those heading for densely populated areas have mostly been intercepted by the Iron Dome missile defense system. Last week, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton worked to mediate the ceasefire and truce between Israel and Hamas, as did Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the UN. They all visited Israel, Ramallah, and the West Bank, and Cairo is where it finally happened. The death toll in Gaza since the beginning of Operation Pillar of Defense is now around 150 Palestinians. Five Israelis died. One wonders what Hamas wished to accomplish with its rocket barrages into Israel. Besides demonstrating a greater range for their rockets and how tough I guess they can be, and killing five innocent Israelis, the main Palestinian achievement of this war seems to have been to effectuate the destruction of most of their rocket supplies and launchers, and to get several of their top officials killed, including the Hamas chief of staff, and oh yes, to see their main buildings completely destroyed. In addition, so far world sympathy has remained mostly with Israel. I fear that the longer this conflict lasts and the higher the number of Palestinian civilians, including children, who are killed, the greater the pull towards sympathy for the Palestinians will become, even though those deaths really rest on the head of Hamas. In the midst of the Gaza conflict, a terrorist bomb exploded on a bus in central Tel Aviv, wounding many Israelis. This was the first such attack since the completion of the border fence in 2006. Hamas terrorists claimed responsibility, and Israeli authorities believe it was an attack from a terrorist Palestinian cell in Gaza. Suspects are now in custody in Israel. Last week, anti-Israel protesters vandalized the Israeli embassy in Denmark and a Reform synagogue in Spain. Some 20 protesters assembled outside the embassy in Hellerup, Denmark, just outside of Copenhagen, and spray-painted the words "child killers" on the white walls that surround the Israeli diplomatic mission. Later in the week, in Barcelona, vandals spray-painted a red swastika and a 13-foot-long graffito on the wall of the city's only Reform synagogue. It read, "Stop killing Gaza's children. Israel kills Zionist genocide assassins." Lovely. Earlier, 200 people participated in an anti-Israel demonstration at Barcelona's Plaza Saint-Germain. Sadly, we can expect more such incidents. On the other side of the ledger, over 7,000 people attended a pro-Israel rally in Paris last week, while pro-Israel rallies and concerts were held everywhere from The Hague in the Netherlands all the way to Sao Paulo, Brazil. With his election last week, Michael Applebaum became the mayor of Montreal, Canada. He was the first non-native French speaker in a century to hold that post, and also the very first Jewish mayor ever for the second largest French-speaking city in the world after Paris. "It's definitely a proud day," said Leo Colbert, a businessman, philanthropist, Canadian senator, and lifelong Montrealer. Applebaum, 49 years old, was chosen by a small margin by city councilors as an independent, calling for transparency in government. His election followed the resignation of former mayor Gerald Tremblay, who quit after revelations of widespread corruption among Montreal officials, contractors, and members of organized crime. As Montreal mayor, Applebaum's position lasts only until elections scheduled for November next year. Applebaum has said he will not seek re-election. "I see very clearly what people are saying on the street," Applebaum said. "I personally have an opportunity to really make a difference." Mazel tov. And for those of you who were fans of Cheryl Teague and Christy Brinkley in the annual Sports Illustrated swimsuit issues back in the 70s and 80s, there is a sad moment this week. Leah Gottlieb, a Holocaust survivor from Hungary who started with a single sewing machine in a refugee camp in the new nation state of Israel and rose to become one of the world's most renowned designers of women's bathing suits, died last week at the age of 94 in Tel Aviv. The company Leah Gottlieb and her family started, Gottex, for Gottlieb Textiles, sold more than 1 million swimsuits a year at its peak. Royalty, movie stars, and of course those SI swimsuit models wore her creations, some inspired by symphonies, others by impressionist paintings. One-piece suits were her specialty, birds, flowers, and waves among her favorite motifs. She made suits from all kinds of materials, velvet, metallic gold fabric, pseudo suede, and they were sexy. "I think maybe I made them too sexy," she said once at the height of Gottex's popularity.
Love, exciting and new.
She said that she realized Gottex was very popular when she was watching the Love Boat TV show and saw that everybody on the screen was wearing one of her bathing suits. Gottex swimsuits and accessories were carried by top department stores like Saks Fifth Avenue, Bloomingdale's, Neiman Marcus, Galeries Lafayette in Paris, Harrods in London. Customers included Elizabeth Taylor, Nancy Kissinger, Caroline of Monaco, Brooke Shields, and Queen Elizabeth II. Can't quite picture her. I don't want to. Anyway, when Leah Gottlieb heard from the manager of her London boutique that Princess Diana had made an appointment to choose a few things for a holiday in the south of France, she jumped on a plane from Israel to London to help. Among the princess's selections were a sexy leopard print one piece, by the way. Gottlieb and her husband Armin, who ran the business end of Gottex, started out after immigrating to Israel in 1949 with nothing, having lost everything during the war. They were both in labor camps, but somehow managed to save both themselves and their two daughters. The Gottliebs fled during the communist takeover of Eastern Europe, and Leah Gottlieb actually sold her wedding ring in Israel in order to buy a sewing machine to start making clothing. She started with raincoats, but then realized it doesn't rain very much in Israel and switched to bathing suits. Less fabric and eventually much higher prices. And the rest was history. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Aron Chari. He's a filmmaker who wrote First Cameraman. He is the first White House videographer, official White House videographer, position created for him at the beginning of the Obama administration. He's traveled extensively with the president, capturing all kinds of public events. He has called himself sort of like President Obama's wedding videographer. Is that a fair description? I mean, it's yours.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it really is because there's certain marks you have to hit, you know, every day, whether it is, you know, for the quote unquote history of everything, you know, you want to get the first dance, you want to make sure you get all that stuff. But things never quite go according to plan, you know, as the day unravels, each day unravels, it starts to deviate off script slightly. And so I think, and also there's a certain amount of hysteria and, you know, everyone and everything seems so important to everyone. And so I think the wedding analogy really hits a lot of those boxes.
It's like one groom with a whole bunch of different guests and brides.
Exactly, exactly. And the groom is fairly calm.
That helps, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He's done this before.
Yeah.
What is it, you know, capturing small moments on video, it seems to me, that's sort of what the medium was made for. I remember doing a million years ago in the 1970s, lugging around a huge video camera and taking black and white videos. And the small stuff was always, the intimate stuff was much easier to capture. How is it trying to capture some of the scope of the presidency?
Well, you know, it is very difficult to get there for those small moments because everything is so magnified when you're president, right? And everything is so heightened and there, you know, there's always people around. We think of this famous photo that everyone really loves of the president and Michelle Obama on inauguration in 2009, and they're in a freight elevator, and they're sort of touching foreheads. And what you don't see in that photo, although you can already see, like, you know, there's a half a dozen Secret Service people there, is that the other half of the elevator is all camera people. And so to be able to sort of maintain your privacy even in public space is something that not everyone can pull off. And so I do think, you know, these special small moments that you described, I was able to get them from President Obama, not because of the position I was in, but because the kind of person he is, because he's just so calm and easy and doesn't mind absolutely being himself at all times. But the other thing that actually aids you, this same concept I'm talking about also helps you in a way, because when you're filming the president, people are so excited to meet him. They're so excited to see him for the first time that you kind of disappear into the background more than you normally would. You know, often the presence of the camera can ruin a small intimate moment. People start performing, they see the camera. But when you're around the president, you're never the most exciting thing or even mildly the most interesting thing in the room, right? The president is.
That's interesting. So because everybody's focused on the president, they're not turning to stare at the camera and say, hi, Mom.
Exactly. And so you really do end up capturing some fantastically authentic material.
How was Hanukkah with the president?
You know, I think like in a lot of families, Hanukkah can just a lot of times be submerged in the holiday season and kind of doesn't hold the candle to Passover.
Oh, that's terrible.
The pun. Yes. In so many ways. But, you know, every year there's a Hanukkah party where the president lights the candles, and I think the vice president also has a Hanukkah party. And for me, it's less symbolic like Passover, and it's more sort of fun because lots of Jewish folks from all over the administration, as well as from Capitol Hill, Supreme Court, all come together. And so it does feel like a very special coming together of, you know, of who's who in the Jewish world of D.C. Because, as you know, the Seder is not at all like that. It's maintained with the same guest list as it always has been. It's just sort of almost like a family affair, you know, those of us who are there in Pennsylvania. The Hanukkah party is much more open to folks. You know, I will say, speaking of Hanukkah, though, in 2007, Hanukkah in Des Moines, Iowa, I came through and realized that no one had gotten a menorah for the office yet. And so when you're in Des Moines, what do? You look up.
You look up the synagogue, Judaica store, synagogue, whatever you find.
You know, right up the street is the fellow who's the town rabbi. He runs a kosher deli and sells, you know, Judaica out of a bookstore.
On the side, he's got a little business.
Yeah, he's got a whole thing going on. And so, you know, came in and, you know, got the whole office set up, everything I needed.
All right, so how did you get the job? I mean, and what did your parents say?
Well, they were very excited when I got the job. Although my mom, you know, as a middle-aged woman from Chappaqua, New York, was a Hillary supporter until very, very deep into the primary. She conceded before Hillary did, but not more than a couple of months. But no, the job, you know, I was a fiction filmmaker, and I was teaching at NYU, and although I was passionate about politics, it was definitely not the kind of thing where you can just kind of breeze into that. You know, when you're a filmmaker and you get into politics, usually it means you're a journalist or you're a documentarian, but that was not my situation. I was just very lucky to be friends, old friends, with a woman named Kate Albright Hanna, who was at CNN and was brought on to be the video director. And she knew that I was passionate about politics and that I really wanted to be involved in the campaign, and just called me up and said, hey, can you move to Chicago next week? And I was getting married the next week, but I said, can you give me a couple of weeks? And, you know, made it out to Chicago.
And your new bride was okay with all that?
She was actually very excited about it. She's a nice Jewish girl from Texas.
Good.
And is also a yellow dog Democrat. And so I'm an independent. So, you know, I liked Senator Obama. I was excited to work on the campaign, but I wasn't necessarily, before I met him, someone, you know, who is overwhelmingly passionate about Democratic politics. But she was. She was like, I think this is great. I think you should do this. And probably regretted it later when I ended up only seeing her twice a month for about 2 years. But, you know,
look,
we got through it.
Opportunity of a lifetime, as they say. You had a couple of wild experiences. Got thrown out of the Indian parliament.
Oh, yeah. You know, I often talk about how I was indulged so much. People were so nice to me. I really was able to film a lot of amazing things and not have a lot of headache and heartache about it. But every now and then you kind of get your ego gets a little too big. You think you can get away with more you can get away with. And especially where you learn about this is when you're in foreign countries. Because, you know, you're close to the president and you're doing things. And, you know, when you're in America, you're like, oh, sorry, you know, but I'm traveling with the president. And people kind of give you the benefit of the doubt. But when you're in a foreign country, obviously, you become a security risk rather than just becoming a guest. And so we were coming into Indian Parliament, and Pete was the only one, Pete Souza, who was my boss and the official photographer, was the only one who had access to this moment at the very beginning before the president was going to come out and make a speech. And so I was, you know, a little disgruntled about it, but I said, that's fine, and I went in with everybody else. And one of the attendants came up to me, and he said, hey, are you Pete Souza? And I thought to myself, yeah, let's just see how this works out. Sure, I'm Pete Souza. And so they're like, well, you're supposed to be up front to get that, you know, to get the signature ceremony. And I was like, sure, well, I'll follow you. And so, you know, he's taking me through all these winding corridors. And then we get to a guard, and they're like, this is Pete Souza. He needs to be inside there. And he's like, that's not Pete Souza. I just let Pete Souza inside already. And the attendant took one look at me, and I kind of was like, oh, you said Pete Souza. unceremoniously, I was thrown out 86.
How long did it take you to live that down?
Never. A very long time, actually. What was funny was, as I was, you know, thrown out, I'm not on my ass. It was on my stomach. Came out on my stomach, the guy who was the motorcade coordinator was kind of folding his arms and looking at me sadly. He's like, what did you get yourself into?
You also once were locked in a White House bathroom while President Obama was conducting a YouTube town hall. I'm sure there are, I don't mean to bring up all your ignominious moments as White House videographer.
No. Well... yes.
Can you explain that to the two Jewish listening audience? I mean, a smart Jewish boy that shouldn't happen.
You know, especially as I have ulcerative colitis, oftentimes I really have to go to the bathroom. You know, and so this is a situation where I really have to go to the bathroom, which is no problem. You know, excuse yourself, you tuck in, and luckily the White House residence is actually full of bathrooms. There's a bathroom in almost every room.
See, that's something you didn't know, listening audience, before you came and listened to Two Jewish this morning. There you go.
Yeah. In the residence, there's almost a bathroom in every single room. But the one that we were in, the library, is one of the few ones that actually has an automatic flushing toilet. And so I, all of a sudden, you know, I was in there doing my business, and one of the camera people came in and was like, you can't move. You can't let the thing go off. It's going to ruin the interview. It's live, blah, blah, blah. And so the interview ended up going on for another hour, and I just sat patiently, hoping desperately against all hopes that the automatic flush wouldn't decide just to get bored and go off.
I hope you had some good reading material, but maybe we spent enough time on that question here. The book is really entertaining. What's next for you?
Well, you know, for this election, I was working in a different capacity on behalf of the president, and that was in the independent expenditure world. I made a lot of ads that folks in swing states saw on behalf of PACs, and super PACs, progressive groups, unions, and I think that work is going to continue now that the president has an agenda and a mandate to fulfill it. I think you'll see a lot of people like me making media, explaining sequestration, explaining the fiscal cliff, and the other issues that are going to have huge impact in the next 4 years in the nation.
I want to thank Arun Chaudhry. I mean, I'm never going to get your last name right.
You got it. Arun Chaudhry.
All right, Arun Chaudhry. For a fantastic visit here on Two Jewish. And, you know, you think with all the Hebrew and Yiddish and Ladino and stuff, I would get a name right once in a while. I want to thank you for a great visit on Two Jewish. The book is called First Cameraman. It's very entertaining. And, you know, you are one of the inventors of the new media, really, in a way. And look forward to see what happens next.
Thank you so much. This was really fun.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Dr. Adina Barel, an Israeli children's book author and scholar of Jewish newspapers and teen writing in Europe in the period before the Second World War. Our playout this morning is also from our pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the Festival of Lights coming up December 8th, less than 2 weeks. It's Peter Yarrow's now classic, Light One Candle. My friends, have a great conclusion to your Thanksgiving weekend, and may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Light one candle for the Maccabee children, give thanks that their life didn't die. Light one candle for the pain they endured, when a right to exist was denied. Light one candle for the terrible sacrifice, justice and freedom demand. And light one candle for the wisdom to know when the peacemaker's time is at hand. Don't let the light go out, it's lasted for so many years. Don't let the light go out, let it shine through our love and our tears. Don't let the light go out, it's lasted for so many years.